Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. We're waiting for Jananand Maharaj to come, but we won't. Then we won't. Any for individuals? It's given. Yeah, okay. But we won't wait to begin the program. We'll begin. Yeah, okay, so by questions. This isn't specifically for me. Oh, I see. You know. Okay. Some devotees rise extremely early to chant all their rounds before Mangalarti, but then cannot stay awake while reading or during Bhagavatam class. Which is more important, chanting 16 rounds before Mangalarti or staying awake and paying attention during Bhagavatam class? Practical question. Well, it might be that if you get up a little later and chant the rounds after Mangalarti, you still fall asleep in Bhagavatam class. There was some discussion a few years ago on one of these email conferences about how much sleep devotees should get a day. And I wrote a comment that devotees get a good 9 hours every day. It's 6 hours at night, 2 hours in the japa period, and 1 hour in the Bhagavatam class. A good way to stay awake in the Bhagavatam class is to give it. But that's not always guaranteed either. Even Srila Prabhupada, he noted that some people say that hearing Srimad Bhagavatam is a good cure for insomnia, Srila Prabhupada said. It shouldn't be like that, should it? We can tell a few jokes and keep everyone awake. Specific to the question, some intelligence is required, in practical intelligence, in this matter. In this regard, Lord Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, what is that? Specifically in regard to this kind of topic, what is that? Anyone? Yukt, say it. Yukta hara viharascha yukta swapnasya bhodashu. One should be regulated in the matter of eating, yukta hara vihara, recreation, dreaming, literally, sleeping. Yukta Swapna Vabodhasya Yoga Bhavati Dukaha. Then the verse before that is Natyashnatastu Yogasti Nachaikantam Anashnataha. What's the next line? I also forgot it. Where's our great verse champion? Yukta Swapna. There we go. Anyway, the import is one should not eat too much or not eat too little, sleep too much or sleep too little. So that will be different for different people. The general advice is to minimize eating and sleeping as much as possible. At the same time, to be alert and awake. Unfortunately, practically every year a few devotees die in road accidents which could have been caused if they had took enough rest instead of driving when they're tired. It happens again and again and again. So you'll have to see. It may be that they don't fall asleep every day in Bhagavatam class. But if it's a regular syndrome, then it would seem to make more sense to rest at night sufficiently, rise in time for Mangalarti, and chant rounds after that. It may be also that some devotees have service during the japa period, and then if they don't chant at that time, it can be very difficult to chant your rounds at all. That's especially true for pujaris and those who are cooking in the morning. There may be others also, those who are looking after the cows here, those who go what we used to call boga runs or flower runs. They used to go early in the morning to the market to get vegetables or fruit. So I won't give an example. I won't give an exact answer, but just use your intelligence. Someone has written, I really appreciate the amount of research that goes into your lectures. Thank you very much. It's research, yeah. I'm wondering if you had resources to share that are similar in depth, like Sahotra Swami, Sadaputa Prabhu. I'm not exactly sure if you're asking me or what other resources are you... I'm not exactly sure what the question is. Am I recommending to some others who research in depth? Anyway, nowadays research is very easy. A lot of research can be done just on the internet. It used to be when I started researching for this book, which eventually was published as Sri Bhaktisiddhanta Vaibhava. It used to be that you had to go and meet people. Actually, with such a book, you'd still have to do that kind of thing. But a lot can be done on the internet. Yeah, you have to do a lot of reading, various things. Exactly how it all comes out is... inspired by Krishna. But I'm not exactly sure what the question... Who asked the question? This question, which I... Maybe I'm not here, whoever asked the question. No? All right. So I just answered two questions, and here are two questions.
You have a choice.
Yeah, you have a choice. You can look through them if you like, but it'll take a few minutes to look through them. I'm told there are none of the kind of questions which wake everyone up or poking, controversial. That was the word I heard, no controversial questions. Although practically anything could be controversial.
They're all controversial. Should we hear or chant? Well, I think that's to you, isn't it?
I don't know. Oh, it said to me, you mentioned the class by the... Okay, while you're looking through that, I'll answer this. You mentioned in a class about the effects of hearing about Krishna on the ears and the heart, and also alluded to the two being different. Can you please explain more about this? Well, I did comment on that hrit karna rasayana katha, hearing and chanting about Krishna, is tonic for the ears and the heart. And I noted that the two are mentioned separately. And I also mentioned that maybe the acharyas, if you see the acharyas' commentaries, they'd noted that, or even if they haven't, then that could be attempted to be explained. And I said that there's so much in the Bhagavatam, it's so rich, Bhagavatam, that you could spend a whole lifetime just meditating upon, and then Krishna will give some insights into various points. But I don't know what distinction has been made by the acharyas in commenting, or if it was, I now remember, I also said that maybe it's just a way to emphasize the point that it's pleasing, hearing about Krishna in the association of devotees is pleasing. So pleasure is experienced in the mind. Well, there's something just came to my mind, how it could be pleasing to the ears and the heart. If the topics are recited in a poetic way or in a sweet voice, we hear that Raghunath Bhatta Goswami used to recite each verse of Bhagavatam in three different tunes, so that's one possible reason. If you look into it, it could probably be explained in various ways, but I haven't deeply looked into that, so I'll leave it at that. You ready for something? In the meantime, these are good ones. You're going to take.
These are the bad ones.
You're going to take the bad ones?
No, but this is a really good one.
There's nothing on it at all.
I can answer that one. Very simple one. Hare Krishna.
That's the answer to all the questions. Shall I answer while you're looking at that?
No, I can answer this.
Okay, go ahead.
Question is, did Srila Prabhupada mention anything specifically about Purushottam month? Which is, of course, this particular month which we're in, this month of Purushottam Mass. Not to my knowledge. I don't know if you ever heard anything.
No, I haven't.
Never heard about it. In fact, from my own experience, and I can't speak for others, maybe in India, devotees were more tuned into these things, but I never heard of it until perhaps 30 years ago.
Which in our time span is quite some time after coming into Krishna consciousness.
Consciousness, yeah, I'd say probably, I don't know, maybe late 80s or something. Maybe. But nothing was mentioned, and probably didn't seemingly mentioned too much emphasis on many of these events, even Kartik.
Yeah.
Wasn't such a... I mean, hardly anyone went to Vrindavan during November, unless Prabhupada was there, like in 72. Then, you know,
it was something which picked up, maybe in the 1980s it started.
Yeah, mainly in the 80s. Not to say there's anything, you know, wrong in that whatsoever, or that we're doing something wrong, but Prabhupada placed more emphasis on the process of devotional service and chanting and hearing and serving the mission and so on, sadhana and what have you. It seemed like, in fact, there's one letter which, I don't know, a letter or conversation, Prabhupada said, particularly Kartik is for karmis, people who are not, you know, following. Devotees, Prabhupada said, more or less every day is Kartik for a devotee.
He gave an example, just like in a shop, they may say that if you buy two, you get one extra free.
Yeah.
Remember that way?
This is high-pitched.
That's a way to attract new customers. But if the ones who are already convinced of the store being a good store will go there anyway without the special offer.
Yeah. But it can be, you could say, these reminders to help us to, you know, renovate or recharge our spiritual enthusiasm. It described in the 11th Canto Bhagavatam how, you know, festivals and dramas and all kinds of different ways of presenting Krishna consciousness are very valuable. It certainly is one of the things Prabhupada wrote, you know, observing festivals is a way of, you know, so charging our enthusiasm, building up our enthusiasm, if it happens to be like that. But we have to be careful. I saw when it's Ekadashi, Nirjala Ekadashi, Vrata,
Oh, Prabhupada said something about that also, didn't he?
Did he say much about it?
Well, he was asked about Bhima Ekadashi, and he said, it doesn't matter what it is, Bhima Ekadashi, Arjuna Ekadashi. He didn't place much emphasis on it.
No, he didn't place much emphasis. And same
but
with
by doing that, he's yeah.
Yeah. But you've got to watch the dangers here, that we miss the point and we get too much kind of like carried away with, you know. Maybe we have a mission, Prabhupada's mission, maybe for those living in India and just basically, say, you know, performing what they call bhajan, staying in the holy dharma or something. These practices are more emphasized, and you know, even sometimes during Prabhupada's time, Chaturmasya, some of the senior devotees were following that, and it wasn't a general thing at all. And it's a Ekadashi I saw when this was introduced in ISKCON on a broader scale than just a few isolated devotees here and there in India, maybe. But
what's that? Chaturmas?
No, Nirjala Ekadashi.
Uh-huh.
Nirjala Ekadashi, they were doing every day, every Ekadashi, I mean, not just Pandava Nirjala, but every Ekadashi. Well, if you can continue everything else, you know, without missing the morning program, without missing your service, without sleeping extra, or next day having a, you know, gorging yourself to the brim on prasadam or something. What to say? If it doesn't interfere with your health, etc., it could be said to be maybe good. But the worst thing is sometimes that we become proud, we become attached, proud, and so on and so forth. We've got to be a little careful that it doesn't have a in an immature stage, a negative, a result. Anyway, you could go on and on with these. There's so many different little details there. Okay.
I could add quite a bit, maybe 5 minutes. I'll speak a little more on that. One thing we can understand, or one thing maybe devotees who are joining now don't understand, is how, since Srila Prabhupada is present, this movement has developed. Just like we didn't know about Purushottam month. Kartik observance was not given any special importance. Going to Vrindavan in Kartik, that began in the 1980s, some point in time.
Probably more in the 90s, I think.
Maybe later, yeah.
Yeah.
It became a big thing. Here's my understanding. Oh, there are so many things, just like we didn't have nearly so many books. We had so many pastimes, Vrindavan pastimes, we didn't know because they were not translated from Sanskrit or Bengali. So, nowadays, if devotees join, they have a huge number of books, and all kinds of people are saying all kinds of things. But at that time it was very simple, and we had much less books. Srila Prabhupada was pushing his disciples in preaching. I'm practically beating them, he said about the book distribution. And also, Srila Prabhupada kept it very simple, considering that his disciples at that time knew very little. Even after he had given some devotees sannyas, when they didn't know how to observe Vyasa Puja in Tokyo, Srila Prabhupada said, "Where is the pushpa?" Which means, "Where are the flowers?" Srila Prabhupada said. And the devotees thought he meant pushpanna, which is a rice preparation. So they had no idea how to observe Vyasa Puja. So
no.
This was even after Prabhupada had made sannyas. He was traveling with sannyasis.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Srila Prabhupada kept it very, very simple. But now we find most of the devotees who come to Krishna consciousness under the banner of ISKCON, for a start, they don't have the same kind of immersion in Krishna consciousness that was the norm among Srila Prabhupada's disciples up till about 1980, because devotee at that time almost exclusively meant, an ISKCON devotee meant someone who lived in the temple, had a full morning program, evening programs, whereas nowadays we have devotees who, most initiated devotees rarely attend a full morning program. A few years ago I was giving a talk in Delhi on a Sunday, and I asked how, about 150 devotees, I asked how many rise every day for Mangalarti at 4:30 in the morning. Two hands went up, and I said, well, that's very good, because generally only those who are retired do that. He said, yeah, they're both retired. Because the pressures of work, coming back late from work, and then getting the children off to school, it becomes very difficult. It's probably not expected that people rise early. So for them, if they can take time out for Kartik or Purushottam months to do some special intensive Krishna consciousness, that's very useful for them especially. That example Srila Prabhupada gave about Kartik, for those who already fully engaged, those already convinced about devotional service, they don't need it. But for those, so it's not exactly the same consideration. Another thing I thought is that when we have, these observances were normal among Vaishnavas previously. They'd strictly observe Kartik vows, Purushottam month vows. They are in Hari Bhakti Vilas after all. Ekadashi observance was normal, fasting. If you do that from a young age, it's much easier. And nowadays people's bodies are such that almost everyone from a young age has some kind of debilitating disease. But Ekadashi observance was very common. That means your last, on the day before Ekadashi, you have a meal at midday, and then you don't take water until the Dwadashi, Paran time, the morning after. So it's a long, and then on Ekadashi night, staying up all night also, not sleeping, engaging in hearing and chanting. So these things, that may be possible as we establish our farm communities. And we have, of course, here we have farm and there's so much work to do, but it should be that we come to a point where the farm is provides facility where we don't have to work so hard, so we have extra time for hearing and chanting. And then for those devotees, it may be practical and possible and desirable and recommended. So things may develop also and change. Yeah.
They may not be expected to work all day long then on Ekadashi.
They may or may not do. It depends. If you have cows, you can't avoid it. If you have young children, you can't avoid it. It depends. And work, I mean, there are some things you have to do.
Rest,
right?
And even Prabhupada writes the isn't it that the writing of Hari Bhakti Vilas is especially meant for India?
Yes.
In other places, it has to be seen according to time.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm just saying, as the movement develops, maybe you get farm communities.
It could well be.
Like that, yeah.
Our temples, probably another factor is kind of related that, you know, that we have the Bhakti Shastri courses and degrees, and it's also many devotees go to India for that or someplace like that. But every temple at that time, in the early days, at least when Prabhupada was there, I don't know when you joined, if it was like that, but when I joined in London, we had 5 classes every day in the temple. 5 a day. Every day. As well as 7 to 8 hours on Harinam Sankirtan. And nobody missed anything. Because we're living in the temple, man, which was specially, specifically, I guess you were talking about devotees were mostly grihasthas when you said you were talking in Delhi, was it?
Well, that's what it is. That's what it is everywhere. Most of the devotees are going to be grihasthas everywhere.
If you sit in the temple in the morning, for instance, there'll be a lot of brahmacharis in the
temple. It was a Sunday morning and
Sunday
it was
mostly
grihasthas.
And devotees living outside. They don't get that. Well, I see a lot of devotees now who are taking advantage at least of modern technology and listening to classes, not just listening but seeing them on Mayapur TV and this and that, following the whole morning program. Some devotees are doing that. I'm making the best use of the situation you're in to associate with devotees. Nothing like direct association, but it's really good in terms of, you know, comparatively good. But this lack of hearing from, you know, Prabhupada's books is, I mean, I don't know in our assembly here today, I think you asked the question this morning or yesterday morning, how many of you have read the 12th canto of Bhagavatam?
All 12 cantos,
yeah. All 12 cantos. And not so many devotees put their hands up. Maybe more than what put their hands up have done it. But it's a common thing that we're reading books in Jiva Dharma, all, no doubt, wonderful literatures. And so many books are on the market. There's a bookstall out there. I'm not sure when Swamiji's got all of his books out there right now. we'll say no more.
By the way, I was stuck in Paris for a few extra hours, and I reread a book which I'd read a few years ago called Animals in Krishna Consciousness.
Ah, at last. At last.
You got a plug.
Your reading materials in line. Well, it is available.
It's written by an author under the pseudonym
Bogus.
Worm.
Worm, yeah, Worm. Alias. Hide your name, you know. No, it's fine, but we do sometimes go overboard and forget the importance.
And you wrote another book also, Prabhupada in Malaysia, right?
You started it. Well, Kundli was also involved.
Uh-huh.
Quite a few devotees had a bash at it.
Yeah.
And did bits and pieces. So
that's, but you followed it through.
I was living there, so it was easier. And, otherwise, you know, emphasis on reading Prabhupada's books regularly. And we start reading many others before. With all due respect, and a lot of devotees have misunderstanding, but so I was talking to Andrew Prabhu one time, and he said to me, unless they've read Prabhupada's books, I think he said six times, they shouldn't read this. He said that to me. His own book, yeah. Mm. And there's no numbers, you can say this and that, but, you know, you won't understand it, even if it is understandable, even if it is bona fide or unbona fide, whatever it is. But, you know, without that foundation, everything we read up above is going to be, you know, driven by our windy mind. Our likes and dislikes, that's the danger. I think a lot of devotees follow their authority when it comes to a lot of these things too, in terms of, you know, even following Kartik or following Purushottam. I think probably a lot of that's come in, and say anything wrong with it, but it's probably one of the influences we have. Prabhupada's our main Siksha Guru, so at least we'll be safe if we try to make his mission the center of our lives.
You want to do one more? Because I was ahead of you.
You were ahead of me.
I did two before.
You're always ahead. You've been ahead of me since 1975. I was ahead of you before that, at least as far as I know.
Okay, I'll tell you all something now. I think you'll like to hear this.
Will I like to hear it?
I came to Bhaktivedanta Manor first time in 1975 by a combination of chance occurrences or Krishna's mercy. I didn't expect to stay overnight, but I did. I was forced to by snow and some other things, and I got up early in the morning. I remember the devotees in the freezing cold dancing blissfully at 4:30 in the morning, and I thought, these people do this every day, they're dancing for God early in the morning. And I particularly remember the look on the face, the blissful look on the face of Jana, I didn't know his name at the time, of course, Jananda Prabhu. That it's imprinted in my mind, that blissful look. So
I used to go to the
Dai Tava Pache Pache.
I used to go to the morning program in those days. We had no choice. We used to really enjoy it. It was very relishable, and still is very relishable. It may be, you know, not always so easy for some reasons or another, but it's always relishable to be in the association of devotees, hearing and chanting. And there really weren't that many other subjects on them, other than if you had gross material things on your mind. There wasn't really anything else. We heard about the Gaudiya Math. They kind of existed, but we never really knew much about it in our early lives. It's like we knew that they were there, the Gaudiya Math, and there was no other. Ritvikism had never been heard of, and all the controversies, or whatever you want to call them, that sometimes occupy our attention today just weren't on the menu.
No.
And offending devotees, of course, that can always happen, but it was... you know, if at all, it was a very kind of quick one thing. We don't have any social media. Social media can be wonderful for spreading Krishna consciousness. It can also be very challenging in terms of maintaining the right attitude in Krishna consciousness also. We associate with people or devotees, different philosophies that certain persons have in the world, certain issues they have. Sometimes it can really occupy your mind, really disturbing. And then, of course, we've had over the years, over the decades, many devotees who've had various experiences which have not been so encouraging. Appreciate and, well, let's say, sympathize, you could say, and whatever else you may say, it seems unfortunate. Nothing happens but chance, you could say. But, and many of these things have become major, you know, major kind of areas of occupying our attention, various, you could go on and on, but it was pretty simple then. You're a devotee, and one day you're just chanting, dancing, and going out on Sankirtan. There weren't many activities then. There was not much of a community in terms of congregation, and life was pretty simple, really. I think even when you joined, it was predominantly like that, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Temple. There weren't like mostly congregations.
No, I don't think there were any congregations.
Hardly any. Very little. It was growing a little bit, but not much. And, you know, you're all together doing the same thing, basically.
They were speaking. Called fringes, whatever.
Fringes, yeah. Anyone outside the temple was like, well, you know, they were kind of devotees.
Remember that? Les fringes, something
fringes,
like that.
Fringes, yeah, fringes. And it was like, you know, it's like a wave. I mean, the first day we ever came to the temple, it was like unbelievable spirit. The whole temple was like totally absorbed in whatever was going on, and you know, everyone was there. The whole temple went out for Hari Nam, except for one or two pujaris. And you know, when it was cleaning, the whole temple cleaned. It wasn't like my job's cleaning and your job's something else. Everyone was cleaning, top to bottom. You know, it was like a big united team, and it really made things very satisfying, very happy, and gave you great strength and confidence.
And you already didn't know much also, even though Prabhupada's books were there, but sometimes, if you join, it takes you time to read them.
Yeah. We didn't have books. We only had one copy of each book in the temple, practically. One or two devotees had their own Gitas. Well, that was it. You know, there was
when I joined up to the fourth canto had been published.
Yeah.
And there were small books. Yeah. And there were the... teachings of Lord Chaitanya, a few books.
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to know what the Ishapanishad was, you had to go to the Ishapanishad class because there was only one copy in the temple. Mm. Same with Bhagavatam. Gitas, maybe a few devotees had their own. And they were the abridged one. You know that little purple one that we used to have? Did you ever see?
No, when I joined this.
No, that was not.
That was 72 Macmillan.
Way beyond that. But when I first came, only that little purple one, it's an abridged version, was the only one generally available. So it was quite simple. You had to go to class, and it was really nice. Well, you don't get that now. Temples, as Maharaj said, many devotees, and not just a congregation, but regular devotees living near a temple, don't go to the morning program fully, and they don't go at all to the evening program. There's often no class in the evening, in most temples in the West, at least. And the morning class is whatever. There, but a lot of times we're not. But then, you know, we were kind of fortunate to get that opportunity to hear everyday Nectar of Devotion, Isa Upanishad, Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. We'd have a song class, by the way. Yesterday one devotee said to me, they were looking at the song book, which we have on the table over there, and they were saying that now it seems like very few devotees sing bhajans anymore.
Mm.
It's next question I have here is kind of related to that. It's very few devotees sing bhajans. Some of you may sing it regularly, but I've seen that in many temples they don't even have song books anymore. Everyone's got their mobiles. So
you don't need it, do you?
Yeah, they look on their mobiles. But it was like a day, every single day except for Sunday, we have a song class every evening, and led by Rivatanandan Swami.
Mm.
And it was so blissful way to finish the evening. You know, it was so nice singing the bhajans, which Prabhupada gave us, authorized bhajans. So that's a lot of little things like that. The temple should be a haven. As Maharaj was saying this morning, that, you know, we can, transformation, probably cultural revolution, transformation of the temple should be like, and not just a managerial basis or basis for socializing, but a base where we can come and get spiritually surcharged. And a lot of the times, maybe we're not so spiritually surcharged, especially if you're living outside, it's understandable. But going to Kartik and what have you, different things like this, does give us, and it states there, I don't know where, but I've read it, it does give us a spiritual surcharge. But if the temples were more and more surcharged automatically, you come to the temple, there's hearing and chanting going on, kirtan going on, and devotees looking a little blissful, and not engaged in talking about, you know, controversial subject matters or world events or whatever it may be that occupies our attention too much, it's very attractive and very encouraging. Is a great relief, a great tonic for our hearts. So you want?
Yeah, you can do the next
one more. We have to keep them short there. That was just one question almost. Is chanting a form of prayer? If not, how to pray to God? I think the first thing I'd say was to understand what do we mean by prayer. What do we mean by prayer? If someone asked you, what does it mean to pray? Is it an easy question? It could be. What would you say if someone asked you, what is a prayer? Pardon? That's nice. You might say that, but in general, and that was ask more service. He said, to ask Krishna for more service. Be careful with that one. But that's an open book kind of a situation, isn't it? You've got to be ready for it. In one sense, we're asking for that when we chant, because it's specifically chanting. I guess you mean chanting Hare Krishna. That's basically, isn't that what we at our stage, maybe some are more advanced, but isn't that more or less what we're asking? Is it or not? Is it right that you're asking for service when you chant? Is it not? I mean, we understand that. That's one meaning which Srila Prabhupada gave and emphasized. My dear Lord Krishna, please engage me in your service. And praying to the internal energy, please, to engage me in the service of Krishna and free us from the engagement of Maya. But from another angle, let's say, what would we say when we say, what is prayer? Is it just a repetition of words? Is it something deeper than that, Sibyl?
Keep a connection with Krishna.
Well, from a devotee's point of view, it's a form of devotional service, one of the ninefold process of devotional service, which can connect us with Krishna. But from our point of view, I don't know if you've noticed this. I've noticed this about myself, and it's probably not the case with you. But many times, let's say we bow down and offer our obeisances when we come into the temple room. How mindful are you? I don't know. How mindful or how mechanical are you? I don't know. I know myself. If I ever remember to check myself, I'm pretty mechanical. I'm not thinking what I'm saying. I'm not even focused on what I'm saying. It's just saying. Mechanical. So we're referring here particularly to the chanting, we presume, of the Maha Mantra. It could be anything, but Maha Mantra. The same principle is there, you know. A prayer is meant to be something which is sincere from your heart. You really are going to, you want it. You're, you know, not, oh, Krishna, just free me from this material world, but we're still maybe quite attached to this material world, and we don't really want that necessarily. I mean, we do and we don't, you could say, but, you know, the more that our chanting is in a prayerful mood, so that prayerful mood of appeal, of, you know, dependence, different degree of surrender, whatever you wish to say, naturally it becomes more and more prayerful, it becomes more and more a real prayer. There's, whenever we approach someone, Prabhupada said, we always ask for something. So even in a neophyte stage, a young person may pray to God, please give me a good job, please give me a nice house, please this and that, whatever it may be that they pray for. So there's some obviously there's some connection there. But if we really want to become deeper and deeper, prayer often refers to something not quite selfless. A devotee on a very advanced level, what would they pray for? Huh? Yeah, well, you can say from Sikshastakam, come birth after birth, yeah. They just want, causeless, there's no other request, or absolutely causeless, just that we become pleasing to you, my Lord. That, you know, we just, whatever, on a much more advanced level. There's not even a thought there of prayer like we know it, it's just automatic. But the more we're conscious, at least at our stage, try to be conscious of what we're doing. When we chant the holy name, try to, you know, remind ourselves, what are we doing here? Why are we chanting? You know, is it just mindless? Are we actually conscious? Do we really want more service? Do we really want it? Sometimes devotees say, Prabhupada, I've got my, okay, so you can look at it in different ways, 64 rounds to chant, I have no time to do service, etc. But you're asking for service in one sense, because it's also service. But, you know, this it's a deep subject. Deep subject. But try to be conscious when we chant or when we offer our pranams. Vanchakalpa, Trubhyas Chaud, Vindai, Tulsi Devi, Priya Keshavasacha. Is it Vishnu Bhakti Maharaj or Krishna Bhakti? We were confused this morning about we should worship Krishna or Vishnu.
Vishnu Bhakti is generic. It's Tulsi also gives
Vrinda
for those who are aiming at Vaikuntha.
Yeah.
So, and Krishna is sometimes referred to as Vishnu.
He's
also
Vishnu, yeah. Nama Om Krishna Pastaya, is that the mantra?
Mm.
You should take it out. Vanchakalpa Trivista. No. Isn't he? Anyway, we're Vaishnavas, so. Yeah, so it's just try to be mindful when we're chanting our japa and when we're offering our prayers and to become personal. Krishna is a person. Someone approaches you, you want to, and they're, you know, placing themselves, let's say, in a mood of dependence. You naturally want to help them. You know what? Krishna knows what we want, he knows what we need. And you'll reciprocate. You know, I'm going to say more on that.
Should I take the ones that have been
well, I think
responded
put,
to?
There it is. They're using our new Mayapur flyers here.
Oh!
I don't know if it's a flyer or an advert, but it's certainly something.
Oh, that shouldn't have been done.
Never mind, it's done now.
I'm going to respond to this and then...
This may be one for you, I don't
go
know.
Go to the bathroom.
No way of telling.
Well, we could both respond to it if
okay,
we have time.
Okay.
And I'm going to go to the bath, so then you can just keep on. respected Swamiji, accept my obeisances, Agspa.
What's that?
AGTSP.
Is that a foreign language?
No, it's it means all glories to Srila Prabhupada. For people who
are
not that enthusiastic to offer their glories.
I wonder why people always wrote that on their letters to me. I just wonder.
Question. As far as your knowledge and convictions, are historical events related in Mahabharata and Ramayana, number one, fictions based on myths and legends. Number two, accurate events with permissive exaggerations due to poetical style of narration. Epic. Number three, a mixture of both one and two. Or legends, which comes to number four. Or legends based on true historical characters, but distorted to appeal to the general public. We heard that Mahabharata was written for lower class people. I wouldn't accept any of these. Accurate events with permissive exaggerations. Who's permitting? Who says it's allowed or not allowed? Due to poetical style of narration. All right, and I don't accept. That's the closest, and then we go back to as far as your knowledge and convictions. In this kind of matter, my knowledge and convictions don't play a part. We have to see how this has been accepted by acharyas and Vaishnavas since time immemorial, and none of them would accept any of these as being correct. Any of these alternatives that have been given here. Traditionally, all the acharyas, they all accept that what is in Mahabharata and Ramayana is a fact. That's all, finished. It's not adjusted to... Now we have science. Science, and people don't believe in four-armed people or ten-headed people or any such things. So, personally, well, my knowledge and conviction, I don't care what these people think. They can say whatever they like. But we accept, as we were taught to accept, as fact. And that's all. But we never saw any ten-headed people. Yeah, you didn't see. Who are you? Some tiny living being on a tiny little planet with tiny little intelligence, tiny little experience. And you want to say, this can't be like that. We don't accept. We accept Shastra as it is. Of course, some stories are directly said to be allegorical, as for instance, the Puranjan narration in the Bhagavatam. Okay, I'll leave that with you. And I'll just go.
Can I just ask a little quick question before you rush? It's very short.
Yeah.
If you've studied, I see you have one book is there, maybe by one of your followers, disciples, I don't know, on the Mahabharata.
Chakrapani, is Krishna history or myth, something like that, yeah.
Looks quite in deep analysis of some kind or another. Didn't read it, just glanced at it. But we read in the, like for instance, is it maybe in the 11th canto of Bhagavatam or somewhere, maybe in the 10th, how Ugrasena, for instance, has, you know, I don't know how many it is, but seemingly countless, bodyguards.
That question was brought to Prabhupada, that in the Bhagavatam, the number of bodyguards only of Ugrasena, that exceeds the present population of the earth several times over. And Prabhupada didn't want to answer the question because it seems because of the attitude with which it was asked. Apparently one of the acharyas was Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur said that's in the spiritual, that's a description of Dwaraka in the spiritual world.
Mm-hmm.
So it may require some clarification by the acharyas to understand that. Srila Prabhupada, when he was asked, or I'm said maybe he himself posed the question that How is it that Krishna would go in the morning from Nandagram to Varshana, which is such a long distance? And some questions, and you would say, well, it's inconceivable, that's all.
Something. You said what?
Inconceivable. Some things are inconceivable. Mm-hmm. And spiritual energy is not constricted to material laws. He also said that sometimes about in the spiritual world, is it like this, is it like that? Prabhupada said, you go there, then you'll see. Right? Unless we accept inconceivability, then we cannot begin to understand God. If God is subject to everything that we... If God has to fit into our rational mind, then He's not God. Inconceivability. Achintya kalu ye bhavana tangs tarkena yojyat prakritebhyo parangyachita tad achintyasya lakshanam. The very nature of that which is achintya, inconceivable, is that it's beyond our power to rationalize. We can discuss as much as we like, but we won't understand. Therefore, we should just accept it.
Just here, even Krishna Prabhupada said, you may not understand it, but just read it,
yeah.
Just hear it.
The idea that everything should be rational according or understandable according to our rational understanding is in itself irrational. Considering that, yeah, we have very little experience, very little knowledge, very little sensory perception. We can only see within a certain spectrum. We can only hear within a certain spectrum. We don't know what's going on just a short distance away from the earth. Or even within the earth. We don't even... what's going on right behind that wall? I don't know. What's going on in India? So, to think that we should be... unless we can understand something, or unless it fits our... what we consider to be correct and possible, then it can't exist. That so-called rationalism is by its own definition irrational. It's self-defeating.
We try to measure things according to our own limited Atakshri Krishna.
Yeah, moment. Frog in the well.
Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, one of his statements is that which can be measured is called Maya.
Yeah, Apiyate iti Maya. It's a dictionary definition, one of the meanings.
Yeah. We always want to measure things, compare, relation it to ourselves.
Man is the measure of all things. Who said that? Parmenides, one early Greek philosopher, and that messed up the Western world ever since.
A very humble statement. But now they become even more humble. The scientists have discovered that we're the most advanced civilization that has ever existed in the course of eternity, anywhere in creation, isn't it? We're the most advanced civilization.
Well, every civilization always thinks like that.
Do they?
Roman civilization, Babylonian, Carthaginian, Greek, Ionian, is it one? The French.
No, never. Never the French. Never.
Louis le Saint God.
No.
Napoleon. They were very upset that the British were able to put their propaganda so that many people all over the world, including the British, still think that they're the paragon of civilization. The French writer said, but we're much more civilized. How did they? By propaganda, the British made it. But the French are thinking, actually, we are the civilized ones. How did they get to be considered the civilized? You know, their language is more sophisticated. And they don't just eat potatoes and cabbage. So,
won't say what they do here.
Their cargo. We know. The British people know. Anyway. Coming to Krishna consciousness means a different worldview, different outlook to that of the materialists.
And it becomes clear as we purify our hearts. purification, things become acceptable.
We're going to have to accept that whatever we thought was correct, we have to start again. It's a different way of understanding the world. Once I was asked by a Madhva Brahmana, that's Madhva Sampradaya, several of whom, Madhva Sampradaya means generally they're the most Shastric, very deeply in Shastra. And several Madhva Brahmanas even today, they've also got PhDs in physics, but they uphold the Shastric version. So one Madhva Brahmana, one thing I notice with Madhva Brahmanas, they often ask you questions to see if you really believe what you're supposed to believe. So he asked me, well, how do you interpret the fifth canto descriptions of the universe?
Mm.
So I said, well, the scientists, they have their methodology. We have our methodology. We accept what's in Shastra. He was happy with that.
Mm.
So, over to you.
Nature school?
Yeah.
Okay. So the next one is probably one of your disciples. I don't know. It's Hare Krishna Maharaj.
How can we best serve you? The disciples don't ask that. Well, they don't ask because you're here on top of them.
They don't. I'm not on top of them. They've given up asking. What to do? How can you? And the next one's almost the same thing. What is the best way to please Guru and Gauranga? Pretty similar, I think. Adding Gauranga was... The guru isn't supposed to be any different in his one with, mean no different intention, no different agenda, no different objective goals, etc., or directions on how to achieve that. How to bless, how we can best serve you? Well, one thing would be, of course, we should find out on the spiritual masters. Are the transparent via media to the Supreme Lord through the media of the transparent disciplic succession. So they receive this, even if they're not realized in the absolute sense of the terminology, and they're receiving directions through the parampara on what is the will of Krishna. So by pleasing the will of Krishna, one pleases one's spiritual master. One finds that out through the spiritual master. Yasya Prasada Bhagavat Prasada. Yasya Prasada Nagati Katopi. So, spiritual master informs us how we can please Krishna. Everything Prabhupada gave us is to help us to develop this change of heart. Spiritual master is very pleased when he sees his disciples following the principles which are appropriate for the change of heart. Krishna himself has given these guidelines, these directions to us, which are for our own change of heart, our own change of perception. So the spiritual master is very pleased. Krishna is very pleased. It's not one's pleased and one's not. But particularly the spiritual master is very pleased when he sees the devotee making a sincere endeavor to follow the instructions which we've received from the parampara, from the guru, from the devotees under the guru's direction. This pleases the spiritual master. And it could go a lot more deeper than that. Obviously, the attitude, the consciousness in which we serve, gradually becoming more and more freed of our own personal agendas, etc. And more with a spirit of wanting to be a pleasing instrument, nimitta matra bhavisava, such an instrument of the will of the Lord, of the Lord's devotees. Many times Srila Prabhupada himself wrote different specifics about how you could please him.
And that will also be the case. Different spiritual masters may have certain specific, initiatives, different aspects. Some may be very much involved in book distribution. Of course, every devotee would be very happy to see any devotee distributing books. Every devotee is happy to see devotees absorbed in service, kirtan, chanting, dancing, and so on. But there may be some specifics within that, how you can please per se, details. The general principle of how you can please your spiritual master is given in Rupa Goswami and the Nectar of Devotion, the various items of devotional service given therein. Our attitude being very important in that sense of how it brings pleasure. One aspect of the spiritual master's relationship is to try to reciprocate in such a way to help us to rectify or adjust sometimes our attitude, sometimes when it's not going, or we're not in the attitude perhaps which is so much pleasing Krishna, we're more in the attitude of pleasing ourselves. Sometimes our service may be in such that we're hoping to get praised, or we're hoping to achieve something which will be, you know, recognized, or so we can get promotion or whatever it may be, or a free trip to India. It's not all totally bad, but it may not be the complete attitude of pure devotional service, selfless attitude. So the attitude is also there, but a sincere attitude. We're making that effort. When a parent sees a child learning to walk, makes the first step, the parent is very pleased. Saying the first words, the parents are very pleased. So we're making that effort. So the spiritual master's instructions, the mission, their mood, the disciples should try to find that out and try to see how we can assist in that. To relieve the spiritual master, probably, and sometimes also say, of various anxiety. Not that the pure devotee is in material anxiety, but there's still anxiety there, and to try to relieve that so that spiritual master has more time for whatever other services. Devotees should think like that, how to assist, not how to give problems, but how to, you know, act in such a way not to give problems. By following the instructions nicely, Krishna will be very pleased with the devotee. So we can also pray for that in regards to prayer, that we can become pleasing to our spiritual master, that we can act in a way which will pleasing to Guru and Gauranga, etc. Our attitude in our service is also very important. But it may start off with the service itself. There are so many statements of Srila Prabhupada, how you can please him, and any service, and one of the bottom line ones, and probably mentioned many times, is keep engaged in devotional service 24 hours a day. Try to fill up the time we have to sleep, do certain activities, but whatever time we have, use it. Don't waste it. Use it in Krishna's service. And details are innumerable. They're innumerable. Just try to do our best and try to serve that mission of the Lord, to spread Krishna consciousness, practice Krishna consciousness, and so on. There's so many details, you could go on and on. The best way, maybe, in terms of detail, will vary from person to person. That one sometimes has to ask or realize in due course of time by one's own experience, pray for, etc. To be engaged in the most appropriate way. And then the second part, there's a two-part here. Should we avoid connection with kith and kin if they're not devotees? How to maintain relationships with them? It can be, in many cases, of course, is the case that the parents are not devotees, or they're different level of devotee. Sometimes when they're not devotees at all, it's can be more black and white. When one's parents are perhaps pious Indian devotees, and many times they're actually are devotees, And they may go to the temple. Many times they brought you to the temple, if you're Indian descent. They may have brought one to the temple, and then when you start talking about joining the temple, I don't know if you, in, any of you have experienced that, then you're getting too serious. This is not the intention at all. It's mostly the intention is just to do something a little pious, punya, and become, act in such a way that you'll have a good karma, a good life, good wife, a good this, a good that. But when you start acting in a way where, wait a minute, now they're giving up the idea of all these things, and they want to, you know, they're no longer going to be a member of the, say, the family lifestyle, with no children, or if they are, they're all, you know, Hare Krishna children. They don't eat meat, and they don't take intoxicants, and they don't party, and they don't go to the whatever event it is that is there in social dealings. Oftentimes the parents become, or the family become, quite disturbed. And that applies all over the world, I think. It applies in the Western world also. How to deal with that? Well, in a neophyte, or say the beginning stages, and sometimes this is a kind of like a frictional situation, quite often. I remember my parents, they were not very, say, they were not at all aware of what Krishna consciousness was. My brother was extremely angry, and my mother was extremely sentimental. My father didn't know really what was going on. So it was difficult to say how to associate. And fortunately, it became not at all. I say unfortunate, but it became not at all for some time, because there was no level of communication. And what the parents wanted, what I wanted, were very different. I didn't know how to bridge the gap. I was trying to preach to them, and it was hell, hopeless. So then when I stopped preaching and just, you know, in top direct preaching, preaching in different ways by behavior, by humble tolerance and so on, and giving little gifts like some nice prasadam and what have you, things started to improve considerably. So it's sometimes the way you present things rather than what you present. Tolerance, it can be good for our spiritual life sometimes. Taking shelter of Krishna, like Gadadhara Pandit, he was basically, it was forced upon him when Vasudeva Dutta wanted him, not Vasudeva Dutta, Balava Acharya wanted him to hear his Bhagavatam recital, and he took shelter of Krishna. But sometimes these situations are there. So should we connect at all? Time, place, and circumstance. It's kind of understood that we've seen in the history of our movement that devotees sometimes didn't at all. And there was sometimes some negative reaction from parents and society to this, which created quite a lot of, let's say, issues and challenges in the movement over the years. So the way, one time when Garga Muni asked Prabhupada, should he, when he goes home, you know, what should he do? His parents wanted to do something else. And Prabhupada said, when you go home, and they ask you to do this, you say, yes, mother, yes, father, yes, yes, but you don't do it. It's, when, of course, when you're at home, you may have to, you know, be a little bit sensitive to the situation, to say the least. So it depends on time and circumstance to a certain extent. And many devotees are lucky, their parents, don't say lucky, but not by luck, but by obvious arrangement, that their parents are favorable, their parents are willing to understand, and to appreciate that you do have your rights, as much as they've made their decision to follow a certain path in life or accepted their parents' path, that they accept, you know, your choice. And they respect, as you respect their choice, they respect your choice. So some are lucky like that, others not so fortunate. So you have to judge it a little bit according to time and circumstance also, but never becoming offensive or aggressive, etc., etc. But it is often quite a delicate issue. We should try to deal with it in a very delicate way, in a very conscientious way. I don't know how your parents were, Maharaj, in terms of your coming to Krishna consciousness movement. Were they favorable or not?
I'd already left home and was independent, so they didn't have any...
Sorry?
I'd already left home and was independent. They didn't have any...
No,
they didn't have any control on me.
That's a common thing in the Western world, when, especially now and in those days, that the children went on their own lives anyway. And sometimes even we see in the world around us that children barely associate for much of their lives. They put their parents in old age people's homes and see them once a year, and they don't really, you know, have much in common in many ways. So it's not so prominent in the Western world, but in Asia still today, I think, maybe getting less, I don't know, but the relationship or the expectations of parents are quite high, or higher, that their children, you know, achieve some kind of social and economic and, you know, whatever position in life. And it can be quite challenging, isn't it, in India, when the children become devotees? Am I right?
Yeah.
Quite challenging. In the West it can be also, but probably lesser, I would say. Less. But respect, devotee respects all accordingly, different ways of respect, and sometimes you do have to keep a healthy distance without any ill meaning or ill intent. But the door is always open. And I said with my parents, after maybe 4 or 5 years, maybe 6, I can't remember, the interaction changed when I stopped trying to preach to them. When I stopped, in their eyes at least, became a little bit more communicable, more normal in their eyes. That, you know, each situation may have slight differences. Slight differences. I don't know what more I can say at this point on that one. It's about how we should, whether we should avoid or whether we should, or how we should deal with kith and kin, depending on, you know, how they deal with us, I suppose. And what level of relationship we should keep. And if you want to add anything to that, Maharaj.
Yeah, many of these questions could be the subject of a lot of discussion. But as time here is limited, I'm going to take a few and just zip through them.
Sure.
So that all the papers that we have here, or almost all, will get some kind of answer. So I'll just zip through, and then whatever's there, I'll leave that to you. What is a bigger obstacle in spreading Krishna consciousness, fanaticism or liberalism? This is too vague to reply to. I need a more specific question. What you understand by fanaticism, how it's an obstacle, and so on. The academia considers that Sanskrit comes from Indo... Yeah, there's the idea of a prototype Indo-European language from which Sanskrit and all other Indo-European languages came. And I did studies in classical philology, Greek and Latin. All my teachers were convinced of that theory. I can say that in my whole life I have never seen a single text in Indo-European language. Does it really exist? A very simple question is no. A very simple answer is no. It's made up to... Something made up which everyone, all the academia, they buy into. Self-deception. Group self-deception. Yeah, there's no single text. It's just based on a theory. There must have been some original language. It's... one of those amazingly bogus things which are accepted by a large number of people who are otherwise intelligent. It fits a narrative, it fits the biological evolution narrative, it fits the narrative that Western civilization is actually civilization, and that... There could not have been anything more advanced before we had McDonald's and KFC and hip-hop
Just a very quick two-liner. In 1976, I was with Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, going from university to university, trying to sell Prabhupada's books in the
England,
UK,
yeah.
in England. And, yeah. And many times we were, you know, we came across the, you know, professors of linguistics, language, and I would say maybe four or five times we went into their offices, in their rooms, and at least all of them, I think, except one, said, yes, we accept Sanskrit as the oldest and original language.
Uh-huh. Well, that's unusual, because the official line is the Proto-Indo-European language.
Yeah.
Maybe they think Sanskrit was the first thing after that. I don't know.
Yeah, that's all I can remember from that.
I remember actually Kalakanda Prabhu told me when he was in, I was in Ireland, when he was in Ireland, we would had a small center, and he and Mahakram Prabhu were doing the university. So in Dublin, in one of the Trinity College or whatever, he said they met a professor whose specialty was studying the links between Sanskrit and Irish Gaelic, which are very close. Also distributing books in Ireland, particularly at one farmer's fair they have every year in Dublin, showing the Isha Upanishad. And several people coming from the west of Ireland, they looked at the transliteration of the Sanskrit in Roman characters and said, is this Irish?
Mm.
Maybe four or five people in a day. Wow. I met a few hundred people. So anyway, as I said, I'll zip through these. How do we know when some event is Krishna's plan or when we made some mistake and messed things up? And there's a smiley face to go with that. When we make a mistake, when we mess things up, we should admit, I messed things up, and not try to say that it was Krishna's plan. That's the simple answer.
That's what Prabhupada said to Brahmananda, wasn't it? When Brahmananda, you know, that deal with that Mr. Price, so they call him, lost a lot of money. And when Brahmananda said, well, we have to see it as Krishna's mercy. Prabhupada said, it's not Krishna's mercy, it's your foolishness. Taking responsibility.
Then another one, can you comment on this quote from Srila Prabhupada that the Krishna conscious movement is for training men to be independently thoughtful in all areas of knowledge and action, not for making bureaucracy? Definitely, it could be commented on in depth, but it's too open-ended. It's, what's the question, actually?
What is bureaucracy?
Well, you can, in such cases, Srila Prabhupada would often consult a dictionary. What is bureaucracy? What does it say in the dictionary? Maybe you, if you have time, you want to comment, but without a specific question, it's hard to say what exactly is being aimed at. And definitely, it has been the subject of much discussion, this quote. Please explain the difference between agyata sukriti, of pious activities executed unknowingly, and the sukriti, or piety, that benefit the people like followers of Satya Sai Ram. Who's Satya Sai Ram? Satya Sai Baba? Satya Sai, see how the people don't know. They actually take it that Ram is Satya Sai Ram. Followers of Satya Sai Rama receive from chanting the Lord's name. Well, maybe there's a little agyata sukriti right there.
Changing the name.
They think that Sai Baba is Rama and Krishna. The sukriti that accrues from, for instance, a living being in the dog body taking prasada, it's completely unknown. He doesn't know. There's no concept, nor is it possible to explain to him what is prasad, who is Krishna. People who say Satya Sai Rama or Sai Krishna or whatever, thinking that Sai Baba, the one who used to have big hair like this, is Krishna, they're actually making an offense to Krishna in doing so. But at the same time, the very fact that they're pronouncing the name gives some piety. And Srila Prabhupada explained that that will eventually help them, but they after they have to suffer for their offenses. So it's not exactly agata sukriti. It's they have some idea that chanting the holy name is pious activity, but it's misplaced, very badly misplaced, so it becomes offensive. So the difference is that one is not mixed with offense, and another is mixed with offense. All right, so over to you for the rest of this.
Finished. There's only two left, right?
Yeah, we only have, according to my watch, less than 5 minutes.
So. Oh, I thought it was 6:15.
Oh, six. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. I zipped through them, but we have actually half an hour. Was that Krishna's plan or my mistake?
You messed up, Maharaj. Admit it. Admit it. You messed up.
Yeah, well, I'm not used to this 24 hours. I saw... Anyway, I try to make excuses.
Did anyone find the dictionary definition of bureaucracy?
Bureaucracy. Well, you can look it up. You can get anything you want.
Here's one which...
on your little thing which...
Probably Maharaj will have a lot to say on as well. Is there any difference in Prabhupada's version of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam and the current version? I think there's a... Is it, would this come into the category of controversy, or is it?
For sure.
It seems to be.
There's an assumption in there that the currently most printed versions are not Prabhupada's versions. There's an assumption there.
Well. What to say? Sometimes we say, judge a thing by its results. So many devotees are, I guess millions of people have come to Krishna consciousness movement, reading the current versions of the BBT publications. We consider they are Prabhupada's books. There are many things you can read, different arguments are there. You could say, people have to say that there are changes. There are certainly changes in some of the grammar. There may be some changes in the words used. There are certainly some changes.
Mistakes have been
changes,
corrected.
Exactly, where changes
such
needed.
Such as the planet of the trees. The
planet of the trees. Or
there is the planet of the trees over which Aryama presides. But it should have been the pit trees.
They thought it was pear trees. So instead of pear trees, it became trees.
Pit trees. Aryama, what is that? Pitrinam Aryama Chasmi. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the purport.
Yeah.
In the 1972 unchanged edition, it states that there is a planet of the trees, but it should have been the pit trees.
Pit trees.
But the devotees at that time never heard of pit trees. So just trees. Pear trees and then trees. Should that remain forever?
Yeah, many of the early books were edited, proofread by devotees who didn't understand Prabhupada's language, his accent, even Sanskrit at all. And it was difficult. And no fault there. What is that verse? Did you quote it this morning? Tadvag Bishago
Janataga Viplava. Yeah. I didn't quote it. I quoted
it. Well, it was
the,
in our class.
A Vaishnava Mokod Girnam, I quoted it.
Yeah, yeah. You know. So, okay, the message got through. Even Prabhupada's first versions in India. The message got through. The devotees were reading those in New York in the early days. But the message got through because the intention was there. It's like we were just hearing just now, the intention of those who chant the holy name of Krishna. What is their understanding there? If the intention of writing or editing or anything is simply to try to put forward the message of the spiritual master and not one's own, let's say, agenda, one's own intention, then certainly there's nothing wrong in that sense. There are many, let's say, little changes that have taken place, but we still see that millions and millions and millions of people are reading these books. When you translate them into French or Spanish or Russian or any language, naturally there's going to be some difficulties with certain words, as we heard from Maharaj the other day. You know, there's not even a word for God in Thai. Is that right?
Mm.
There's no word for God in the Thai language, you know. So sometimes it is a little
difficult. Not with the conceptual connotations that we have in English, French.
Mm-hmm. So it is a delicate issue, and the idea, the understanding is that, you know, with consultation or with many senior devotees, some of them directly, I mean even Jayadvaita Maharaj was directly, let's say, working with Srila Prabhupada. He was probably one of the last ones to record his spoken words in Vrindavan. He had a lot of association in regards to editing and proofreading, etc. And other trusted disciples of Srila Prabhupada are doing their level best to try to present that same message. And of course, it's a little controversial that some devotees will feel disturbed. And we do also sometimes when we learn a translation from 1971 or 2 version or whatever it was, and then a little bit changed. Translations worded somewhat differently or whatever it may be. So, but if we see where the fruits of the endeavor that millions of people are coming forward, taking up Krishna consciousness still, they're not becoming followers of such as Sai Ram or somebody else, but they're taking up this mission of Krishna consciousness, that it indicates that, you know, there's something positive is there. It's not that, you know, Prabhupada's books have been hijacked or anything. I can read both versions and feel equally, you can say, inspired of both versions. There's not much difference, but whatever way you want to call it, some minor changes are there in wordings and what have you. I don't know about the Bhagavatam. I can't remember the differences there at all. But in the Bhagavad Gita, of course, they point out so many different things, but it's still the better we get on with what we know is to be done and focus on what is obvious instead of picking and fighting over little details and wasting our time when we could be getting on distributing the books. And it's interesting to note some of the people who claim this, they never distribute the books anyway, even the original one. Some do, some don't. We should get on with this, our business. We know what our business is. We haven't got so much time to debate. Somebody has to do these things, no doubt. But, you know, we get on with our business. Let that be done by those who are, you know, needed to do those type of things. BBT editors or others, whatever it may be. Get on with our business. Distribute, follow the teaching. Share it with others. Preach Krishna consciousness and get on with it. Krishna will reveal everything. If we're actually sincere and chanting with all our sincerity we can, then Krishna will reveal. Anyway, I don't know. A little controversial there. Anything else?
Yeah, there is a body of devotees who are going through each change made in the Bhagavad Gita as it is and examining it to see if it fits the guidelines that Srila Prabhupada gave. So we may have another edition coming up after some time. That's
I believe that's commissioned by the GPC in consultation with the BBT. But I wonder, then there will have proponents of the 1972 edition and proponents of the 1983 or 4 edition, and then will there be another edition, and they'll...
Some people will complain about
that. They'll say that that's not good either. I personally consider it a disservice to distribute where it says the planet of the trees, which is clearly wrong, that's being distributed at the headquarters of the world capital of Ritvikism in Bangalore. That's being distributed that edition. But that Bangalore also happens to be the probably either Bangalore or Madras, probably Bangalore is the city in which has most traditional Vedic Brahmanas who know Sanskrit very well and converse with each other in Sanskrit and write books for each other in Sanskrit. And if they see that, they'll either think that your guru is foolish, or you'll think that the disciples are foolish. They made a mistake. Why didn't they correct it after all these years? Either way, it's wrong. It's not what Prabhupada said. Why should we retain it? There are others like the demigods and the demons once went on a sea journey. It should have been sea churning, churning the ocean. So some things clearly should be.
There's also that one multicolored.
Multicolored
like
the sea. Multicolored, just sea.
There's lots of little things you could find like that.
Then there's Hayagriva Prabhu. He was editing. And he had a long beard, and Srila Prabhupada wrote about shaving regularly. And he shaved out the part about having a long beard, not having beards, because he didn't like it. He
edited it out.
Edited it out, yeah. So there are considerations like that.
Okay, another one. Did you find bureaucracy?
Oh, then you got it. Yeah.
Well, this might be one.
You were asked to define bureaucracy. What do you mean by bureaucracy?
What dictionary have you got here?
Cambridge.
Okay, is that authorized?
Yeah, that's generally considered
okay. A good one.
Good source.
Oxford, I know Oxford dictionary. Okay. A system for controlling or managing a country, company or organization that is operated by a large number of officials employed to follow rules carefully.
That's one definition.
Yeah, is there another one?
Well, if you look in another dictionary,
yeah, you'll find slightly different variations.
If you look in a political science book, you'll probably find much more elaborate definitions.
Is it a control system?
I didn't think of it as a control system. I thought of it as a facilitating system.
It looks here more of a control system.
That's probably because the academia is infected by leftism.
Okay. Well,
it infects everything. Everything coming out of the academia is affected
by leftism.
Yeah.
What is the famous letter from Prabhupada to Kurandara, isn't it?
Yeah, this is what it's quoting from. Yeah. The quote.
Very famous. I don't know if we have the whole letter or what, but the gist of the letter is that Prabhupada didn't want that everything should be so centralized, you know, under controlled like
but
that.
But also, it doesn't mean that he didn't want systems.
He did wanted a system.
He wanted systems.
Yeah. But not that everything should be centralized, that the different branches and the different devotees running centers around the movement should also have, you know, a certain, and in terms of practicality, a certain degree of responsibility and management. Otherwise, we can stifle the individual's enthusiasm, the individual's initiative, etc. There's a fine line, this unity and diversity. Cooperation is a very I guess, interpreted differently by different people, how we work, operate together. We may have our own differences, our own different perspectives sometimes on things, but how we can serve, putting Krishna in the center. All things, what will help us to put more and more Krishna's will in the center, and less of our own interpretation or our own perspective of it. I would probably want the devotees, but independent of, let's say, our material conditioning, not just independent. Our idea of independence is often based on our material conditioning. It's not based upon, you know, some kind of many, many authorities, many, many paths, etc. But rather is based upon our individual desires, our individual conditioning, etc., etc. And we tend to see things accordingly, judge things accordingly. So the more and more we're independent of being controlled by our conditioning, or the conditioning of, as you mentioned just now, the leftism or rightism or liberalism or radicalism or thisism and thatism, but more and more seeing things in relationship with Krishna. Each of us is individual, we may see Krishna some slightly different angle, but seeing Krishna in the center more and more and more, and not just according to our conditioning. And if we try to establish a controlling system, which to some degree you could say is likely to be the case, but if we establish the system, or whatever form of management it may be, based upon our own whatever conditioning we have, there's bound to be certain friction there, there's bound to be certain misunderstandings there. So the real independent thoughtful person is we're independent of the control of basing our lives upon whatever conditioning we have, when we try to take shelter of Guru, Shastra and Sadhu, try to take shelter of the process of devotional service. And gradually we hope, as we progress in spiritual life, we'll see more and more the unity and diversity, and especially coming together for hearing and chanting and kirtan and sankirtan, going for sankirtan, etc., helps very much in this regards to start to see things in their real... What is the point of the institution? What is the point of an organization, whether it's bureaucratic or whatever else it may be? We have to always remember what the point is. If it's helping us to develop our love for Krishna, our devotion to Krishna, it can be seen in that light rather than just an efficient system of administration based upon a certain person's perspective. As I guess in the course of history, most controllers would probably feel that they know the best, even if they do annihilate very vast numbers of persons in the course of doing so. But the Krishna consciousness movement is established to facilitate its purpose. What is the spirit of this movement? Not just what is the form, but the spirit, the purpose, to awaken within us our love or our attraction towards Krishna. So if it works, if it's helping us to awaken our attraction towards Krishna, it can be seen in that light. Maharaj, maybe you'd like to...
Oh yeah, a lot more could be said.
There's so much you could say on that one.
Well, Srila Prabhupada wrote that, obviously, because he had perceived that the effects of institutionalization were taking place. The Max Weber's institutionalization of charisma. And probably many of us who have been in this room for a few years, myself definitely included, yourself probably, have met frustration in dealing or trying to deal with the organization as an organization, and the kind of institutionalism and bureaucratic systems that we meet. It's very hard to get a point across. If you disagree with something, it's very difficult to get the point across, or even to be heard. And that's maybe one reason why some shout loudly and regularly, and with the idea that the duck that quacks the loudest gets the most bread, or like that. So yeah, it is one approach, or is to take the essence of the movement and hearing and chanting. There are issues also. One of them, as Srila Prabhupada warned about, is becoming overly official, bureaucratic, impersonal. Generally, we think of a bureaucracy as impersonal, right? It's just you have at the Indian railway stations complaint box. You can put your complaint in writing and put it in the box. And the box is always empty, because not that it's emptied regularly, because no one bothers to put anything in the box. If they have a complaint and they're really passionate about it, then they organize a bunch of people and do a rail roko, which means you get a bunch of people standing on the rail lines and stop all the trains moving, and then people listen to them. So it's not that all these syndromes which sociologists study, it's not that ISKCON is somehow magically aloof from them or unaffected by them. We're dealing with human beings, after all. And yeah, these are things that Srila Prabhupada warned about. It's an ongoing question, and as long as ISKCON goes on, or any religious institution goes on, it will always be a question. The needs of the individual versus the needs of the institution. So it's something to be aware of, but at the same time, it's best not to be overly not get so absorbed in this that we lose our taste for hearing and chanting about Krishna. Please explain if Sri Krishna Bhakti eradicates the results of devotees being unable to follow all Vedic family responsibility. We know in today's world it is difficult to fulfill everyone's responsibility, and there's a conflict of family responsibilities in the family. Didn't you just answer this when I came?
It was related to that, but it wasn't direct. It was related.
A verse that Srila Prabhupada quotes in his Bhagavad Gita, as it is commentary and elsewhere, he quotes it more than once in his Gita commentary, is that verse, Devarshi Bhutapta Nunang Pitrinam Nakinkaro Nayam Rani Charajan Sarvatmana Yasharanang Sharanyam Gatomokondam Parihritya Kartam. The one who is completely surrendered at the lotus feet of Mukunda, who has taken fully shelter in he who is the one who should be taken shelter of, no longer has obligations to the devas, the demigods, the rishis, the great saintly persons and teachers, living beings in general, family members, Pitrinam, Devarshi Bhutapta, Nrinam, people in general, and the forefathers. They no longer have obligations. A key term there is one who is fully surrendered. Nakinkaro Nairin, Sarvatmana, one who has fully dedicated himself, no longer has any obligations. So that is a consideration. Are we fully surrendered? Ramanuja took sannyas. He had a young wife. Look what he did. Do we recommend every young man who's not happy with his wife to leave them and take sannyas? No. But Ramanuja did. And look what he did after taking sannyas. Srila Prabhupada was blamed by his family members, by his wife and his sons for abandoning them. But look what he did. So are we absolved from family responsibilities by taking to Krishna consciousness? Well, it's something similar to the yayata mang prapadyante tang sataiva bhajami aham. That much we surrender, that much we are free from obligation. Otherwise, obligations are there, and in the name of devotional service, we shouldn't be irresponsible. Just that also sets a very bad example. If we just, in the name, I want to do devotion, therefore I'm leaving my family. Often we find that those who, it's a common syndrome, the persons who renounce immaturely, when they're renouncing, that's in the mode of passion, renunciation in the mode of passion, because one finds that the situation is troublesome, therefore you renounce it. It's not so much that you want to do devotion, but you want to avoid the responsibility. But the material desires are there, and we often find that those who immaturely renounce one family situation end up in another family situation because their desire for enjoyment is, or for family life is not, they haven't overcome that. So that's very irresponsible. It's difficult to fulfill everyone's responsibility. There's a conflict of Vedic responsibilities in the family. To fully fulfill responsibilities or to fully satisfy everyone is not possible because there are always demands. So at some point it's good to renounce. But one can't do that. One can't renounce. A man can't renounce his family even in old age if he hasn't, while discharging his family responsibilities, gone on hearing about the temporality of this world, about the entanglement that accrues from family attachment. So we see that sometimes devotees who are, I heard recently a devotee who's 80 plus years old just got remarried.
80 plus, never too late.
It won't be for sex. I very much doubt it's for sex.
Pardon?
I very much doubt that, but it's the pungsastriya.
They weren't a sannyasi, were they?
Well, he was a sannyasi at one point long ago.
Well, there is a nice statement of Srila Prabhupada in one conversation in Calcutta, where Prabhupada was talking about one of his early childhood inspirations. He was saying, when I was a young child, in fact, there was one elderly man in the area. You know that one? And around about 80 years old, he got married.
He said he was a great devotee.
Great devotee. Tamal Krishnaraj went, Prabhupada, isn't that a bit old? And Prabhupada says, yes, but he was a very nice devotee. Mm. He said, there are incidences like this also in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Mm. But we shouldn't imitate.
But that's not the behavior. And generally, that's not taken as the behavior of an acharya.
No, it's not the precedent.
Although we have Srinivas Acharya, who married for the second time at the behest of, who he was 50 plus or something, and he married again.
Yes.
That in the early days of the Sampradaya, it was expected that devotees, the Vedic process, you marry, you have a family. Sannyas was generally not for young men. So he married. Srinivas Shamananda married. Narottam didn't marry. He lived at home, or in his home place, but he didn't marry. So we have to see. There are different examples. But in general, Vairagya Vidya, this should be renunciation based on knowledge, but also not Markata Vairagya, the renunciation of a monkey who's still jumping around looking for sense enjoyment. Each case will be different, but in general, every one should be responsible. If you're going to renounce and take sannyas at an early age, you should do something. Do something substantial. Prabhupada used that word. Should do something substantial with it. Not just a means to avoid responsibilities. And also men, if they may not want to marry just because they want to avoid responsibility, but then at the same time they're not fully renounced. But we're talking about the Vedic system, they should marry and take the responsibility of women need to be married, children need to be brought into this world to be trained as devotees. Anything else? You'll hear different things from different people on this, and that's also confusing. Huh?
That was another one of the easy things in the early days. You didn't really hear much from anyone else. You just heard from Prabhupada, and those would just say, they heard from Prabhupada, and nobody really had any much experience beyond that. It's quite simple. Now we're in a third generation, I suppose, in Prabhupada's movement, and different experiences, different ages, different opinions about different things are quite there. But the basic simplicity that Prabhupada gave us is also still there as a foundation.
There was quite a lot of this disagreement between devotees, as I remember. It was mostly at the leadership level.
When you joined, there was. 74 it started in England.
Oh, there was a lot of politics in England, yeah.
At that time.
Yeah,
74, I joined 75. After that. You joined just after
but
that.
But still, there were...
Yeah.
Sannyasi was meant really heavy, nasty. That was the general perception. Really. Very, very heavy. Was it not?
Yes.
Well, very, very... It was almost like a competition. Yeah. Guru on the wall. Who is the heaviest of them all? Hans Duda made a song like that.
Hansa Duda.
Yeah, he made a song like that.
There are 11 big gurus sitting on the wall.
So many things could be discussed. Gaurangera arotik shobha jaga jana manaloba. The beautiful arati of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu attracts all the minds of all the people of the world. So, hopefully it will attract us also. We can also go. Evening arati, if you're in the temple, attend. For many years I thought, well, I have so many things to do, I'm too busy. But then I thought, well, why not chant Hare Krishna in the evening also? And I'm really glad that I've been doing that for the last few years when possible, attending evening arties. Mm-hmm. It's bliss. Another thing is that, I don't want to overstep the bureaucracy here, but there's no rule against, is there any rule against dancing in kirtans? We have a lot of devotees, they're congregational devotees, they're maybe not used to this, but we ask, it's... Krishna is pleased when we dance in the kirtan, so you can do so also. So many elaborate philosophical discussions, but we could also dance in the kirtan. As you know, some bodies are old, some are tired, but we can dance. So it's time now for the beautiful arati of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu on the bank of the Ganga, in Navadvip, being enacted here. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
All glories to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada.
Jai.